Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. It's your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 11th of July, 2013. I am still in the flatlands of Flanders, and so I have perhaps one more installment of Travels with the Turton to record. But this briefing is the sixth installment under the generic title, Where the Nightmare Ends, and Nav Briefing 73. And this installment is entitled Sophia's Magnificat. I told you I would be getting back to that theme, and so here we are. Let me just say briefly before I begin that there was a change of Dakini shift on Monday in the morning. I believe it was around 7:15 a.m. Universal Time. And I was sitting up here in the grenier, in the attic, in my writing studio, waiting for a call from coast to coast. So Monday morning I did a two-hour interview on coast to coast. And that was in the very first moments of the current shift. So some of you have been asking which Dakini came on shift. Well, it was pretty much a slam dunk for Vajra Yogini due to the location of the new moon, the exact degree of the new moon. It was pretty certain that the first sighting of the sunset crescent would occur on Tuesday or Wednesday with the moon located in the constellation of the Crab, even though that is a diminutive constellation. The composite of the Crab is only about 20 degrees of extent on the ecliptic, that is in the zone of stars where the moon moves. And so 20 degrees of extent on the ecliptic is only about 40 hours. It's less than 2 days' time the moon transits through the Crab. But due to the timing of this new moon, it's pretty clear that the shift goes to Vajra Yogini, a.k.a. Tantra Mother, or as some people would say, Miss Piggy, although there are those among you who find that term irreverent. But you know, irreverence is never wasted on the Gaian Dakinis. They enjoy it and get a big chuckle out of it, I can assure you. The term Miss Piggy comes from the Sanskrit-Tibetan jargon. Vajra Yogini may also be Vajra Varahi, which is a very unuser-friendly term. Vajra means diamond or thunderbolt or crystalline or adamantine. There's various ways it's translated. Varahi means sow. So you have the diamond sow or the adamantine sow. Are nicknames in the old tradition for this Dakini. And in Tibetan, you have Dorje Phagmo. Dorje being the Tibetan word for Vajra, and Phagmo being the Tibetan word for pig or sow. So we can throw Miss Piggy along in there. She won't be insulted if you call her Miss Piggy. And call her anything you like. That is the nature of the Gaian Dakinis. They don't come to you and tell you who they are. They rely on your capacity to identify them. And it's a really important point I've made numerous times. It's an important standard of planetary tantra and Gaian tantra. And that standard by which the practitioner identifies and names the frequency, distinguishes this practice from channeling and other New Age make-believe. So it's one way it distinguishes it from New Age make-believe. So I must say that there was a sensational kickoff of the Vajrayogini shift this year, and I might have occasion to go into that a little more in another briefing. But right now, I want to go directly to the material that is comprised by this theme, Sophia's Magnificat. As I said before, there was a moment, it was on July 7th, right? Yeah, Sunday, July 7th, just the day before the Coast to Coast interview. And I spoke quite extensively about the particular parameters of that moment. And I even had Simon post with the NAV briefing a notation of how to write that moment in code. It was the 68th day of summer and the 26th day of the Idris shift, hence S68.I26, and then the code indicating the events that happened at that moment, the lunar apogee, the stall, the station of Jupiter, the station of Saturn, and so forth, the position of Jupiter locked into the apogee, and the station of Saturn close to the star Kambalia. And the claim that I made at that time is worth repeating because it's a beautiful claim. This is the first moment since March of 2011 that the Aeon Sophia is able to perfectly coordinate her first and second attention in the operations that she's undertaking to correct this experiment. So that in itself could be celebrated. There is cause to celebrate. There is cause to remember that extraordinary moment just a few days ago, just 4 days ago now, in the very dark of the moon, in the very next to the last day of the shift of Idris. She is the mistress of fate. And so, as you all know, whether you're in the crew or not, the fate of humanity now hangs in the balance, and the fate of humanity decides the outcome of this experience, of this divine experiment, that which is unfolding on this planet. So you all know, as crew members, the precise and specific parameters that I use to define the moment of Sophia's Magnificat. And also, let me remind you once again that the stall in 2 degrees of Cancer, coinciding with the perihelion of Saturn during this summer, can be defined as the Gnostic moment. So where it occurred on July 7th, a few days after American Independence Day, what a joke that is. Perhaps sometime in the future, America will become independent, but it never has been until now. So there's no independence to celebrate except that which is to be won. But the assumption of independence is certainly an illusion. So that moment can be considered a high point in the Gnostic moment, the turning point in the Gnostic moment. Is 7th of July 2013. So I pulled this term Magnificat out of the air somehow, and I can't even remember now what I said about it. You know, this is how it goes. Anyway, did I say that the word Magnificat, which refers to a choral song sung in adoration of the Virgin Mary, carries the term magnification. In fact, if you add an O at the end of it, you have the word magnificato, and you're getting toward the Latin word magnification, found in alchemical writings. I did speak, I think, of the three stages of the great work of alchemy in one of those grok talks going back into last year. The three stages of alchemy are formation, fixation, and magnification. And you can apply those three stages to the three stages of initialization of Sophia's correction. And the application is natural and easy and user-friendly. It's sweet and obvious. So we know that there are three vast lessons to be learned relating to the satanic head of Cetus and the constellation of the ram or bodhisattva, relating to the bull, and now relating to the twins. Well, those three great lessons correspond quite neatly to formation, ram, Cetus, fixation, the bull, and magnification, the twins. So there you go. I mean, mythopoiesis in action. That's what this experiment is. And it is mythopoetically correct and mythopoetically brilliant, I would say, that the event of July 7th announces the beginning of the Magnificatio of alchemy, and that it should be announced by Sophia's Magnificat. I didn't plan it that way. I didn't foresee it. I didn't see when we started this experiment that I would be telling you this now, did I? It's spontaneously emergent as you own and engage and test and apply the powers of your imagination linked to hers and linked to the story and rigorously held within the framework of the story. You know, I refer you back to that alchemical principle taken from the collection of the 16th century, the Theatrum Chimicum, I think it's called, or the Artis Aurifere, the art of gold making, I can't remember, where the alchemist advises that you accomplish the great work by using the true and not the fantastic imagination. The true imagination is imagination that resonates and generates with the imagination of the earth, of the Aeon Sophia. And that is the only true imagination. You know, I made an outrageous statement not too long ago, and I realized I needed to qualify it and back it up. And then I had some brilliant notion of how to do so. And of course, that went in the wind. And it could come back in the wind. So when the moment comes back, I'm going to qualify what I said. Well, it was an outrageous thing to say, which was that any operation of human imagination creatively in any realm or genre, be it science, art, music, dance, literature, any operation of human imagination that is not coactive with the divine imagination of Sophia is demential. Remember, I used that term. It is demential. Woo! Hold on just a second here. Now, let's take a look at War and Peace by Tolstoy. Some people might consider that to be a great novel, a great work of human imagination, you know, or the art of Picasso, or the art of Frida Kahlo, whatever you want. What am I doing? Am I condemning all these people and saying that all these great artists through history who produced great works of imagination because their imagination was not coactive with hers were demential? So I obviously need to qualify that statement. The answer is yes and no. So it does require a little clarification. But I'm not going to go there right now. What I'm going to do right now, in the context of this briefing, is to look at the previous version of Sophia's Magnificat. Now, first of all, to do that, I'm going to define what her Magnificat is, and I think you can see this coming. In conventional terms, a Magnificat is a chorus sung in adoration of the Virgin Mary, right? This is a Catholic gig, right? Okay. And I guess Bach has written Magnificats, and various composers have composed Magnificats. So, human animals, in praise and celebration of the Virgin Mary, sing the Magnificat. All right? So the Virgin Mary is a fiction of human imagination, you know, that may or may not in some ways be tangentially related to the presence of the Aeon Sophia in human imagination. So you could say the Virgin Mary might, in some respects, be considered as a filter in human imagination that overlays the presence of the Aeon Sophia. Probably the Black Virgin tradition would be indicative of human imagination reaching toward the Virgin Sophia, because the Black Virgin is a code term for the occlusion of the organic light of the Aeon Sophia in the realm of materiality. You see, if you look now outside, give an example. I'm standing here at the window of the grenier and I'm looking outside, and there's a wall in front of me with square tiles on it. And that's the and there's a peaked roof, and I'm looking directly at the vertical wall. That is the house next door. It's about 20 feet from me. And so I am looking from inside the grenier through the window, out through 20 feet of space, which is filled with sunlight, or such as you get sunlight in Belgium, and looking at a wall covered with tiles. Now, if you want to look at that wall in an occult way, then you imagine something like carbon paper. Imagine, can you remember what carbon paper was? Probably some of you have never even seen carbon paper. You're young enough not to know. It's a sheet of black paper, which is kind of flimsy. It's like a film, and it's covered with carbon. So it's totally black. And of course, when you type on carbon paper, it creates an imprint or a copy on the page beneath it. Okay. Imagine a sheet of carbon paper that is attached to the other side of what I'm looking at. So what I'm looking at is a surface. And even though it has slight detail in it, because I can see the depth of these tiles, which are about half an inch thick, even though it has some surface to it, it could just be a photograph. So first step is, I imagine that I'm looking at a photograph of this wall. Now I know if it were a photograph and I went out and touched it, it would be perfectly flat. So I reduce the dimension of depth, and I just regard the wall as if it's a flat photographic image in front of me. Now I imagine that on the other side of the photographic paper, there's carbon paper. So, what is behind this wall is complete blackness. Just practice that visualization for a moment. See what it does to you. See how it affects you. And then see if you can understand what the Black Virgin meant to those human animals who used to go into caves and grottos and sit there in the dark, looking at a black virgin which was invisible in the dark. Why would you go sit in a grot, in a grotto, like the original grotto that was down in the ground where the Cathedral of Chartres was later constructed? Why would you go and sit there in the dark in front of a dark idol that you can't see? Well, it's like the exercise that I just proposed, you see? The dark virgin represents the occlusion of the organic light of the Aeon Sophia by the appearances of materiality that she produces by her dreaming power. Because when she produces these appearances of materiality, fields, clouds, mountains, rivers, trees, rocks, the earth beneath your feet, the grassy lawn, the pastures, the flatlands of Flanders, where I see potatoes, corn, and linen, and oats growing. And she produces all these impressions by the occlusion of the numinous presence of her own aeonic luminosity. And it's as if she were to lay down a black filter against her luminosity of the whiteness of the organic light. And upon that black filter, that black screen, she projects the objects of her imagination, which are in fact real and material. They're not illusions. And those objects include not only what she purely makes, like a tree or a massive boulder, but also the objects that human beings fashion out of everything that she makes. So it's certain that the icons of the Black Virgin were associated with this kind of occult contemplation of how the primary substance body of Sophia, which is the organic light, is veiled or occluded by the material appearances that she herself dreams into physical reality. She dreams into physical reality. That is the power of Maya Shakti, to dream an appearance into physical reality, to materialize what would merely appear in the form of a mirage, for instance, or what would merely be an illusion. This material world is no illusion. This material world, it is an illusion to take it for an illusion. This material world is a concrete expression of the power of aeonic dreaming. And no doubt when people sat in those grottos, they experienced a contact with that mothering Maya power, a deep, consoling internal connection. And also because these black Madonnas are derived from Paleolithic carvings of the Earth Mother, isn't that obvious? You don't have to read Jean Marcal to know that. Okay, then obviously they felt in the presence of the earth as the material body of the goddess, and there was an interior access to her. So I much prefer the Black Madonnas, I'm sure you would too, because the Virgin Mary was a perversion of that genuine contact with her infernal presence within the material elements. And there followed, of course, the elevation of the Virgin Mary into a celestial deity, something standing in the sky or in the clouds or standing in some way beyond the material earth, which is an illusion and a demented fiction and a lie. So today we're not going to consider singing a Magnificat to that overblown image of the divine feminine, which has been used both to exalt and shame women down through the ages. We're going to go from the Virgin Mother of the Savior straight to the whore of wisdom herself. From the virgin to the whore, and I prefer to keep company with the whore, who is, of course, the greatest virgin of all, because she conceives without a partner. Sophia is Parthenos. Sophia is a virgin and has been so from the beginning of this adventure, because she conceived the experiment that we are now in. Anthropos 10, by a unilateral dreaming independent of an aeonic consort, didn't she? So she is both our virgin and our whore. And now is the moment for her Magnificat, which is not sung to her, but I submit to you that it's sung by her. Sophia, the planetary animal mother, sings her Magnificat to the universe in praise of the Anthropos. And how do I know that? Well, of course you know how I know that, the same way you know that, because the precedent for it can be found in the received materials, and I have it right here in front of me. I always keep a copy of that wretched book, the Nag Hammadi Library, in English, up here in the grenier. So I don't have my standard scholarly version, that is to say with the Coptic facing pages and so forth. I just have this wretched book that they sell to people. And I have it open to page 175. This is a text called On the Origin of the World, and it occurs in two books of Nag Hammadi. It occurs in the second book as the fifth document, and in the 13th book as the second document. And in the passage indicated by the numbers in bold, in the passage 103, there is a record of Sophia's Magnificat. So I'm just going to read it to you verbatim, just like it is. I'm not going to edit it. I'm not going to rephrase it or try to polish it up in any way. Here goes. It begins with a declaration by Yaldabaoth, that is the Demiurge, the Lord of the Archons, the Lord of the Clones, and then the response from Sophia, which is her Magnificat. Now when the heavens had consolidated themselves along with their forces in all their administration, the prime parent Yaldabaoth became insolent, and he was honored by all the army of angels, and all the gods and their angels gave blessing and honor to him. And for his part he was delighted and continually boasted, saying to them, I have no need of anyone. He said, it is I who am God, and there is no other one that exists apart from me. And when he said this, he sinned against all the immortal beings who give answer. And they laid it to his charge. Then when Pistis, Sophia, saw the impiety of the chief ruler, she was filled with anger. She was invisible. She said, you are mistaken, Samael, that is, blind God. There is an immortal man of light who has been in existence before you and who will appear among your mottled forms. He will trample you to scorn just as potter's clay is pounded. And you will descend to your mother, the abyss, along with those that belong to you. For at the consummation of your works, the entire defect that has become visible out of the truth will be abolished, and it will cease to be and will be like what has never been. Saying this, Pistis revealed her likeness of her greatness in the waters, and so doing, she withdrew up to her light. Now when Sabaoth, the son of Yaldabaoth, heard the voice of Pistis, he sang praises to her, and he condemned the father at the word of Pistis. And he praised her because she had instructed them about the immortal man and his light. Then Pistis Sophia stretched out her finger and poured upon him, Sabaoth, some light from her light to be a condemnation of his father. Then when Sabaoth was illumined, he received great authority against all the forces of chaos. Since that day, he has been called Lord of the Forces. I'll stop right there for now. The passage goes on. 176, 177, 178. It gets to be pretty interesting here. The term Eros appears in the Nag Hammadi writings in passage 109 of On the Origin of the World. And this extensive passage also describes the attempt of the Archons to rape Eve, who is called the Sarkic Eve, S-A-R-K-I-K. That occurs in passage 116, and it goes on and on and on. And the Gnostic version of the temptation of Eve, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, can be found in On the Origin of the World in passage 119. And that is a very much quoted passage, which says, "Now Eve had confidence in the words of the instructor." And that line, as scholars will tell you, utilizes a pun in Aramaic, which equates the word instructor with the serpent in the Garden of Eden. And of course, that is the Gnostic version of that particular myth. And then it goes on and on. Adam and Eve, the rulers were envious of Adam. That is to say, the Archons are envious of humanity. This is a recurrent theme in the Gnostic instruction. The role of Sophia Zoe, who is connected with the vital forces emanating from the sun that support life on Earth, hence sun-earth form part of the Gaian ecosystem. The sun is an external part of the Gaian ecosystem. And then on and on through the warning that the Archons have instructed humanity in many kinds of error and in false magic and potions and the worship of idols and spilling of blood. And all the way down to page 189 and to the conclusion of the drama caused by the presence of the Archons and a kind of brief apocalyptic passage, you might say, describing what happens at the consummation of the age. And it's very rare, as I've noted, to find any apocalyptic doomsday passages in the Gnostic writings, but they do occur, and the cosmological document On the Origin of the World concludes with one. Now here I'm just talking about, well, start with 103. I'm talking about 15 pages, 14 and a half pages of the Nag Hammadi Library in English. I could spend the next 6 months sifting through this and trying to make sense of this, and I could probably make sense of, if I made sense of 15% of it, it would be a huge success. If I or any of you were able to delve into this material in these 14 pages and bring it around, work on it like screenwriters working as a team on a movie script, if you were to undertake it in that way and attempt to bring some elements of this long passage into a new definition and incorporate it into the narrative of FGS 3.0 or FGS 4.0, even better, that would be a magnificent accomplishment. But I have to tell you that it's very clear to me, and it becomes clear to me more and more every day that goes by. And I even got a chance to mention this on this rather wretched coast-to-coast program, which is not a platform suitable to the caliber of my instructions. Okay. I even got to mention that the leaders of the mystery cells worked in pairs. 2, 4, 8, 16. And they had to, because they had to work in teams to manage this material. Can you see that? I mean, it would take 3 or 4 people working together for a couple of months to convert this raw material from the codices into something that's useful today, and something that would add and amplify and enhance FGS as the narrative is unfolding. So for right now, I'm not going to tackle any of those passages, except I will point to one snippet that came out of my reading of On the Origin of the World. Just one. I could name maybe 5 or 6 things, but I just mentioned this one that jumped out. I thought it was remarkable when death appears. Now, death comes from the sun. I think I've told you that before. It's called the D-force. Castaneda called it the tumbler, and it is much to the credit of Carlos Castaneda that he did so. I would like to ask you, if Carlos Castaneda was inventing this Neo-Toltec sorcery, then his invention must be regarded as an authentic invention, because he identified very clearly the D-force, and he explained that it is a force that emanates from the eagle, while the eagle is the sun, solar eagle. And the D-force is also part of the narrative I'm citing here. Passage 106. Now, when the prime parent of chaos, this again is Ealdabaoth, the Demiurge, the Lord of the Archons, saw his son Sabaoth and the glory that was in, and perceived that he was the greatest of all the authorities of chaos, he envied him. And having become wrathful, he, the Demiurge, engendered death out of his death. And he, that is death, was established over the sixth heaven, for Sabaoth had been snatched up from there. And thus the number of the 6 authorities of chaos was achieved. Now, this is amazing, because in one way you could read it and say, oh, well, it must be the Demiurge, it must be the reptilian lord of the Archons who inflicts death on us, you see. But that's not exactly how to read this passage. It's like so many of these passages, it's very obscure. And Ealdabaoth, having become wrathful, engendered death out of his death. Okay, this is how I would read that. Due to the envious wrath of Ealdabaoth, Sophia produced death, with a capital D, out of the threat of death that he would impose. This is how you have to read it. And that reading corresponds to exactly to what is the function of the D-force. And it corresponds to the understanding that you can reach of the transcendental nature of death given to the human animal. The Aeon Sophia gives us a special version of death. She gives us a way to die, which is intimately related to the sun, Sabaoth, to the sixfold nature of the solar power, which is the power of the sixth heaven, and intimately related to that faction or group of archons who defected from the Demiurge and aligned themselves to the Aeon Sophia. And those benevolent archons are called receivers or paralemptors. Paralemptor. It's a very strange word, only found in the Gnostic writings. And scholars translate it as the receivers. Who are these receivers? They are the population of archons who live in the sun and in the atmosphere of the sun. And they assist the massive process of death and the recycling of human consciousness. So the D-force is what comes out of the sun and breaks down the aura or life membrane of a human animal. Castaneda describes this in graphic detail. At the moment when that animal can no longer vitally sustain its own auric field, that's what we call death. But death is actually, through the D-force, a retrieval of that life force. The unspent life force of that animal is retrieved into the sun and held in what is called the treasury or depository of light, which is the internal part of the sun, which is cool and blue, by the way. And I believe certain people have reported that. And so this is a tremendous passage. But it even gets better. Because if you read on, it talks about the D-force, death. It's not talking about the demiurge now. Try to get it into your head that the death that you undergo as a human animal, inevitably, is a special process provided for the Anthropos, even before the Anthropos appeared in this experiment. She provided us with a special system by which the unlived vitality of each animal would be recaptured and recycled to add again power and force to the Anthropos, to give it the power of rejuvenation out of its own death. That's what the D-force does. It does break down the membrane. It does kill you. That's what it's called, the D-force, you know. But it kills you so that it can retrieve the unlived forces and also the lived out forces, because they both get stored in different ways. The unlived forces of any human animal, the unlived forces of any life, are taken back to the depository of light in the sun. And the lived forces are redistributed into the genomic makeup of the human being, where they are configured in that 95% of DNA that scientists call junk. But to get to the point, I don't want to elaborate too much because obviously I'm digressing from the Magnificat here. To conclude this digression, just let me say this. I find it remarkable that On the Origin of the World hints, or indicates, if you will, the creation of 49 androgynous demons associated with the death power. Now, the names of some of these demons are bitter weeping, suffering, lamentation, pain, sighing, bitterness, and wrath. In fact, in general, you could say that they represent wrathful deities. Well, an array of 49 wrathful deities. Does that strike a bell? Does that make you think of anything? And additionally, in the following passage, 107, there is a second collection or array of benevolent deities called good androgynous forces produced by Zoe. Now, does this remind you of anything? What you have is an after-death scenario, an after-life scenario. And presiding over this afterlife scenario is the magnificent regal figure of death itself, which could be called Yama in the Asian correlation. Yama, Lord of Death, the D-force. Presiding over two arrays of wrathful and peaceful deities, which is exactly what you see in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Isn't it? Except that in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you have 42 the mandala of peaceful deities, 42 in number, and the mandala of wrathful deities, 58 in number. So there's a discrepancy in the numbers here, a slight discrepancy, but it's exactly the same scenario. So what is the takeaway of this digression? The takeaway is that even before human animals began to appear on the earth, and even before the planetary habitat for our species was created, the divine Sophia, in full possession of her pronoia, her forward-looking intentionality, set up the conditions for the after-death experience of the human animal in collaboration with Sabaoth, who is the mother's son, and in collaboration with the Paralemptors, who were those archons who defected from the ranks of the Demiurge. This is a magnificent picture that belongs in one of the episodes of the FGS, obviously, in the ongoing elaboration of those episodes. So now at the 45-minute point in this briefing, return and concentrate on the notion of the Magnificat. We know what was Sophia's Magnificat then. That was her pre-terrestrial Magnificat. Wow. Her pre-terrestrial Magnificat has gimongous ramifications. Enormous. Not only did she put the Demiurge in his place and assure him, Yaldabaoth, that at the consummation of his works, that luminous child would triumph over him, but she went to elaborate measures to set up the cosmic conditions of death and rebirth that would be required due to the fact that the Anthropos was facing an extraordinary setup with the Archons that was not previewed or anticipated in her original dreaming. So what you see in this passage is the cosmic mother, the aeonic mother, she's not even yet become the planetary animal mother. Here is our aeonic mother taking measures for the protection of the Anthropos and the protection of its intelligence and its life force. And to do so, she makes a pact with the sun, which is pretty amazing the way it's described. You know, I wonder if plasma cosmology in the electric universe is going to get to that point, if they could ever get to that point, where they would understand that the divine Sophia herself conferred upon the plasmic eddy that we call a sun its particular properties, which are both vital properties, pranic, and electrical properties. So the vital and electrical properties that the sun exhibits, which makes it a part of the Gaian ecosystem, were conferred upon it by the Aeon Sophia herself. Get that on board. And this is what it says explicitly. She put out her finger, and she conferred it upon the sun. And the sun was converted by that into her ally. This is a great episode in the Fallen Goddess scenario, as you know. Well, that was her Magnificat back in those days, before the earth existed. So what's her Magnificat now? And what evidence or reflection or ramification or hint or clue could we possibly look for to show, to prove that she is singing her Magnificat? Well, before I give you some of my notions or proposals or reflections on how that might be proceeding, and especially upon how we might detect the pronouncement of her Magnificat, I just want to say a quote, a wonderful line that came up in an email recently from one of the crew members. It was such a simple thing to say. Quote, she wants to see us turn this around as much as we do. Quote, you know, she wants us to succeed as much as we do. Quote, it's just, what a wonderful statement, you know. I mean, it's so heartful. And it's not a statement of hope or of optimism. It's just a statement of dynamism, you know. Just think how much you, as a single human animal, want to see this divine experiment turned around and restored to its original design and purpose. And how you live with that every day. It's like in your cells. It's what you feel in every human encounter. It's what you breathe in and breathe out of your body. The desire for that to be so. And she wants it to be so as well. Just as much as we do. And so if her desire to turn around this experiment now combines in an intimate alchemical manner by the convergence of the first and second attention of the aeon with our human desire, that represents the threshold of a new synergy. Or you could also coin the word a new syntropy. S-Y-N-T-R-O-P-Y. Her Magnificat introduces, perhaps, a new syntropy. That would be a syntropy within both the natural order of this world and the moral order of this world. See, because one of the great problems with this experiment, the key problem I'm beginning to think as I was bicycling through the Flanders fields today, is the great question of the dissociation of the natural and moral orders. The natural order of things, the laws and cycles of the natural world, which is the habitat for the human animal, stands by itself. And then there are the moral laws in the moral order, which is a social construct. And never the twain shall meet. Now, even though we can be nostalgic and we can look back, for instance, go read Ezra Pound's translation of The Unwobbling Pivot and the groundwork of Confucian philosophy, which is absolutely unsurpassed in Ezra Pound's translation, or go read Gary Snyder, or even Arne Naess, who's one of the founders of deep ecology, who my quote in Not in His Image, and these people are saying, hey, listen, wake up, folks, wake up, animals. The moral order that ought to regulate the society of human animals must be drawn from the natural order. The moral and the natural order ought to resonate together. And we can look back at a time, maybe sometime way, way long ago in ancient China, certainly not in China today. We can look at the sometimes over-idealized cultures of indigenous peoples, and I suffer from that fault as well, of over-idealizing them. We can look at all that nostalgically, and we can say, oh, wait, oh yeah, there was a time when the natural order and the moral order were, what is the word, synergetic. And maybe they were, but they're not now, and this is the critical problem. Probably the core problem of this experiment. I'm beginning to see this now. And I have a strong intuition that this is an instruction of Mother Tantra. I have a lot to say about, of Tantra Mother. I have a lot to say about the instruction of Tantra Mother. I've been pretty much in a blaze of instruction of Tantra Mother from 7 o'clock in the morning on Monday, July 8th. I'm calling her Mama Teach. Mama Teach this, Mama Teach that. Mama Teach the coordination of the natural and social orders, the new syntropy begins at the moment of her Magnificat, and it is, in fact, the expression of the breathing and emanation of her Magnificat, of her divine breath breathing upon this experiment. And nothing less than that will do. Wouldn't you say? Nothing less than that will do. Just as she breathes into the emergent plasmic vortex, which we now recognize as that sun shining out there, which at first was nothing but an eddy, an empty eddy, flowing through the third galactic arm. Just as she breathes into it, a dynamic format, for the solar and pranic energies, she now can breathe into the atmosphere of the earth that which is required for the new syntropy. Now remember, let's get the syntax clear here. I proposed a while back that in the Gaian navigation experiment, you don't use those terms, positive feedback and negative feedback, because they're bad terms, it's bad syntax. So positive feedback, which is actually destructive, is what causes a bridge to be blown apart by the wind when the bridge is caused to undulate to the point where the undulations reinforce each other in a negative feedback loop, and then the bridge blows apart. That's dystrophic feedback. D-Y-S-T-R-O-P-I-C. Dystropic. Meaning turning, or tropos, toward destruction or disorder. D-Y-S-T-R-O-P-I-C. The opposite, which is called negative feedback, is when you have homeostasis and an organism continually restores itself to optimum function. But I call that syntropic feedback. S-Y-N, meaning working together organically as a whole in a holistic unity. And tropic, therefore turning toward a holistic unity. So there is the new syntropy. And I pointed out a while ago that both of these trends are now escalating or accelerating at a momentous pace. In other words, there is a vast acceleration of dystropic events, both in nature and in the social order. But at the same time, simultaneously, there begins in the 3 years of correction, and oh, it is so good to be so right about this and to be so right on. I never imagined I would live in this moment to be able to talk to you like this. Out of the vital flux of the very experiment itself, you know? In these 3 years of correction, there is born a syntropic escalation toward the harmonization of the planet. And as I said during the Mirita shift, that harmonization will take 10 minutes of her time, which is about 200 years, a little over 200 years of human time. So she can resynchronize, syncopate. She can resynchronize all the natural processes of the planet to their optimum holistic harmony, syncopate the life rhythms of the planet with the pulsations of the Pleroma in 10 minutes of her time. And she initializes the conditions for that in 10 seconds of her time. So Sophia's Magnificat is the moment now when she introduces, through her presence, through her power to attend to the experiment, her liberated power of attention now comes into play. It took up until this point in the 3 years for her power to be liberated to the degree that she can give it the attention it takes to kick off this syntropic escalation. We're at the very first seconds of this syntropic escalation. Now, that's a big claim to make, and I'd like to conclude this briefing with a few proposals as regarding what to observe to see if this claim is true. I'm not going to show you or tell you, I'm not going to make one claim upon another claim. First of all, I'm claiming that this is happening. Got that. I'm not going to claim that I see evidence that it's happening. I'm going to leave it for you to observe if you see evidence that it's happening. But I am going to propose or direct or steer your attention a little bit with my syntax toward those events that might provide such evidence, okay? That's my intention. So I would cover like 4 items here, okay? First item is, look for an expansion of resistance in the collective. I think I can dare now to make a step in the GNE. You know how cautious I am about even suggesting that we would see evidence in the collective behavior, in the psychodrama of social life, that her correction is taking effect. You know how cautious I am about that. Nevertheless, paradoxically, that is exactly what we anticipate, isn't it? But this art of anticipation, as I think you will understand by now, is a highly nuanced art. It's like the art of the hunter that I'm teaching you. It's the art of stalking, because I am a stalker, not a dreamer. Those are the 2 types of sorcerers, you know. It's always good to know which type you are. And as a stalker, the Nawal would teach you exactly in the same way that a hunter would teach you, walking through the forest, walking through the Amazonian rainforest, noticing the traces of animal life. What is your prey? You know, maybe it's the wild boar. And noticing the traces of where the boar has been, noticing where the boar dug up some ground, which you can also see here in the hills of Andalusia, the jabalí, the wild boar. And the hunter teaches you to anticipate the moment when the prey appears, right? You do that by making subtle observations along the way to the moment when the prey appears. So this is really an archaic technique, the art of anticipation, as applied in the GNE. So anticipate that you may see from whatever news arises out of the collective drama signs of an expansion of resistance to the power of the authorities and to the deceit, division, and domination that they perpetrate. One of the greatest signs of resistance that I'm seeing is resistance in Syria. I told you, Syria, which is the homeland of the Levantine mysteries, and the place, as Lydia of Damascus would assure you, where the integral form of the Sophianic narrative was preserved by the Telestai, that Syria is now on the front line in the battle of the Jewish Bolsheviks to have their empire in the East. So they get other nations, particularly America, to fight the proxy wars for them. And if Syria falls, it's Lebanon and Iran. Everybody who's analyzing the geopolitics of the moment is saying that. I'm not a geopolitical analyst. It's as obvious, it's as plain as the nose on your face. As Syria falls, so the whole Middle East will fall under the Jewish plan of master race domination. And they will have their kingdom from the Nile to the Euphrates with the capital in Jerusalem. This is their dream. This is their nightmare. This is the nightmare they wish for humanity. They wish to fulfill their nightmare. And they've been brooding on this nightmare for a long time. But consider the resistance to this nightmare. Consider what just happened in Egypt, which in fact did happen at the moment of the July 7th event, didn't it? Consider the resistance wherein the Russian president shamed that wretched shithouse rat, Cameron, Prime Minister of England, shamed him publicly in a press conference saying, "Do you want to supply arms to people who are cutting people's heads off and filming it and eating their hearts and putting it on the internet?" In addition to that, a team of Russian scientists recently investigated the claims, the lies, that the government forces of Assad, who are defending the sovereignty of that country, Syria, used sarin gas, when in fact the Russians have shown that it was the rebels who used sarin gas. So there's resistance against the plan to overthrow Syria and proceed with this insane Zionist agenda. There's resistance to the NSA due to the Snowden whistleblowing affair, which I have to say I'm very dubious about, but nevertheless, you know, I would make this observation. You could know when the syntropic escalation was increasing by seeing numerous incidents wherein the authorities are doing their usual vaudeville of terror and control, and that it's backfiring on them. You know, I strongly feel, and a number of analysts have said this, that the Snowden affair could be a limited hangout. Go look at what that means. I don't have time to explain because there's only 5 minutes left in this briefing. But even, say, if the Snowden affair were a limited hangout, and even if Snowden doesn't even exist, say that it's a spy op. He's been invented in order to execute a massive mind control program regarding the way that humanity responds to totalitarian surveillance. This is possible. This is within the realm of thinking of the archontified humans. But when even their tactics get out of control, they can't control their tactics of control anymore. This is a sign that there's an expansion of resistance and that the syntropic trend is gaining. Another sign would be an acceleration of the breakdown of their systems. Okay? So, at the same moment that the authorities, the feds in the United States primarily, who are run by the Zionists, look at Homeland Security run by Michael Chertoff just as an easy shot, a cheap shot. The feds, just at the moment that they are launching the massive specter of totalitarian surveillance over the entire world and continuing to perpetrate their crimes under the name of national security, that the system that is required for them to implement their lies has become so cumbersome and complicated that it is disintegrating all by itself. So there's an increase of the dystropic activity. Look for that. Look for their systems to break down, to fail, particularly the surveillance systems, because surveillance is the mark of the archons. We have been under surveillance. The human species has been under surveillance by the archons, and there are billions of them, for countless aeons of time, or eons of time, in this experiment, but rigorously under surveillance for about the last 16 or 18,000 years, okay? Rigorously under surveillance by the Archons. So look for the technology that is required, which the Archons themselves kindly and conveniently provide. The technology provided for that surveillance to be breaking down and collapsing. Finally, I want to give you a sense of what I consider to be the real thrust and beauty within Sophia's Magnificat. This, I can tell you in one sweet and simple proposition, the magnification of her power to correct the experience happens as she regains pronoia. Pronoia is what she used in the pre-terrestrial episodes described in On the Origin of the World. Pronoia is pre-thinking. It is to think about something before it happens and to take measures for what is to happen. That's pronoia. Unfortunately, it's translated by Gnostic scholars as providence. It's not, but it is in a way providence. I mean, it's her providence. It's a way to provide for what is to come. So when you go to the beach and you have an ice box in the back of your car and you put in some bags of ice in the car, that's pronoia. That's providence. You are providing for the need that will arise when you're out on the beach and you are away from any place that you can buy ice, that you have ice in the cooler. That's pronoia. So her pronoia was extremely hampered and has been extremely hampered for a very, very long time due to the conditions of her separation from the Pleroma. But all of that began to change, well, you know when, in the first week of September 2012. With the establishment of Pleromic Relay operating through the Pleiades, the Aeon Sophia is now on a lifeline to the Pleromic Aeons. In the first months after Relay was established, she uploaded a massive amount of her biographical data to the galactic core, to the galactic headquarters. That gave the Aeons the ability to know what she had been experiencing in isolation within this experiment. Remember that the lunar apogee is designated as divine memory. You will recall that from the beginning of this experiment, I said that we will trace her recapitulation by the lunar apogee. So, at the onset of the 3 years, the lunar apogee is located in the Fishes. It advances past the Satanic Head of Cetus with the ram above, bodhisattva looking down. It advances into the bull, and now it has reached the feet of the twins. And by the time it passes between the head of the twins, the 10 seconds are completed. At the beginning of the GNE, it was correct to think of the lunar apogee in terms of divine memory and recapitulation by the wisdom goddess. And I sent out in the crew notes a rather complicated linear sequence, and it's impossible to put in a linear sequence really, but a rather elaborate but crude linear sequencing of the recapitulations of the wisdom goddess. However, remember that divine memory and divine imagination are the same function. Once Pleromic Relay is established, more and more of her power of second attention is liberated to function as imaginative power, and it does not require use in a memory function. So, this is the liberation of her pronoia. As her imaginative power is freed up, she can apply her pronoia to the task at hand. She can project into the collective psyche of humanity the power of her own providence, of her own providential vision for humanity. And she can provide for the Anthropos what it needs to assist her in correcting this experiment. I would say that 10 months or so after Pleuromic Relay was established, which was July 2013, she underwent a significant change in this respect. Pleuromic Relay now holds the mother ship in alignment to the galactic core. And the support of the Pleuromic Aeons is there at every single moment. Hence, her second attention is liberated. Pronoia operates through the second attention, and it is applied in the first attention. So, when we're going to the beach, there's the cooler sitting in the back of the car. My pronoia, which pictures us at the beach, far away from any place where I could go buy ice, causes me to imagine the act of putting the ice in the cooler. Then I have to use my first attention to go and find the ice. Say there are sacks of ice in the freezer, in the cellar of the house. With my first attention, I go and get those sacks of ice, and I put them in the cooler, that is to say, fulfilling the conditions of providence provided by my second attention. And this is exactly what she's doing now, and she's coordinating them instantaneously. And her Magnificat is not merely to sing the praises of humanity, because she's no longer in the cosmic environment out there with the Demiurge over here and Sabaoth over here. She is in material immanence in the planet. So her singing of her own Magnificat would be the way that she proves to the cosmos at large, if you will, she proves what humanity can actually do. This is the moment to show up, to correct this experiment. And I would guess that there are human animals out there on this planet who don't know anything about this experiment. They don't have the syntax and the scope that you have. But I would suspect that they also know that this is the moment to show up and stand up for humanity. And I strongly feel that the shift from Idris to Mama Teach was perfect timing. Because within the context of this current Vajrayogini shift, I can see something emerging that is truly magnificent, truly unparalleled up until this moment in the GNE. And that's the theme that I will pick up in the following NAV briefing. I can't put a name on it right now. I was going to say slam dunk for Miss Piggy, but you know, who knows? This is things that comes to my mind. But it's the theme of conscience. Conscience is the theme here. Conscience considered in the framework of the question, and I leave you with this question: how to coordinate the realm of natural order with moral order. How to coordinate natural and moral order. This is the question with which I would conclude this briefing.